Have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid: high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable. It's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast. Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? Ew, seriously. They squeeze the grease out of the wool and process it with chemicals, and then you eat it. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I got rid of products I didn't want anywhere near my body. I found that many multivitamins contain high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and even lacked some of the nutrients we actually needed. So what did I do? At 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. Ritual's products are made traceable, meaning we share the science and sourcing for every single ingredient. For example, our vegan vitamin D3 comes from sustainably harvested lichen in Nottingham, England, not sheep. We trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. See for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
So much for joining us here today. I really do appreciate it. We do have a good one for you here, as always. And, you know, here's a little bit about what we're going to be getting into on the show today. We're talking a little bit about Virginia, the Walmart shooting that just took place there recently, and another reminder of the tragic, tragic work that we have to do in areas regarding gun control and so, so much more when it comes to, you know, really some of the most important issues of our time. Just how short we are focused, especially when talking about the took place at Club Q, that's in Colorado, with the shooting at the gay bar. I think the latest on that, and so a really actually great piece about you know, why it's so important to be a gay bar in the New York Times, and just, you know, being proud of the gay rights kind of struggle, and you know, all the things that have been so, so tough for gay people kind of in their struggle for acceptance over the years. Also, we'll take a look at why the World Cup should make us kind of a rethink of our understanding of human rights here, which I find to be very interesting. And we'll take a look at 10 things Americans actually do have to be thankful for. We're going to do a little bit of rare positivity here from Newsflash on the holiday season. So it is a, you know, quite a good time to be here. You know, thank you so much, everybody, for joining us on this Thanksgiving show. Apologize for the tardiness of it in nature, but yeah, hopefully that does not discourage all from kind of enjoying the show, enjoying it, you know, what hopefully is a chill holiday, nothing too crazy with the family or anything like that. But you know, with that being said, it is important that we're gonna get right into today's show. So we're starting off with a little bit about the shooting taking place recently. In, obviously, that's in Virginia. So that has added to the nation's gun toll just recently. This was the last night, as we saw shoppers in Chesapeake, Virginia, browsing for household items or Thanksgiving necessities. And an employee of a Walmart in Chesapeake took out a pistol and, without a word, opened fire, killing five of his co-workers and a 16-year-old boy before turning the weapon on himself. And it's really, I think it shows you, at a very fundamental level, just how crazy our country is becoming. And really, I think the sense that a lot of people have that it just, there is no way to do, there's no real way, no effective way to control what is happening in a really everyday basis. Well, not every day, obviously, but, you know, an all too common basis in our, you know, in literally every possible place and kind of imaginable in American life. It's just been happening over and over again and again.
So, yes, it's Chesapeake, Virginia this time. The bodies of the gunman and the two victims were found in an employee break room, the authorities said, and another near the front of the store. The three died after being taken to nearby hospitals. The burst of workplace violence just after 10 p.m. on a Tuesday tore at the holiday cheer of a popular shopping center, now cordoned off with yellow police tape. And it threatened the nation again for the third time in less than 2 weeks into a familiar cycle of increasingly frequent cycle of mourning, soul searching, prayer sending, and finger pointing in the aftermath of really yet another mass shooting. And I you know, this is obviously a very tragic situation. Five people dead in a Walmart, you know, doing their Thanksgiving shopping. It really is just a sign of, I think, the fact that we as a, you know, a people, and we as a country can't imagine really effectively a world where this does not happen on a day-to-day basis, which is so insane, where we are literally the only country where this regularly happens. So, you know, it's a real kind of testament to, you know, the state of our political institutions, the state of the way things are. Just, we are fundamentally unable to create a political system that can fix problems where we see just people being gunned out, kids, just anyone, anywhere, at any time, just not safe from just this just really awful scourge. I think, you know, there is something, you know, uniquely horrific, I would say, honestly, about the gay shooting, the gay bar shooting, where five people were also killed and 18 others wounded at this Colorado Club Q nightclub. Colorado Springs, for those of you who don't know, it is a very anti-gay area, big military base area, big, you know, with the Mormon church and all that. It is a place where, you know, there is not a lot of room for that kind of expression. Club Q, for all accounts, was a place where there was a lot of acceptance of that. It was a real haven for a lot of queer people. And the fact that really, you know, I think what makes it so uniquely horrific, It was not the fact that, unfortunately, you know, five people died. Five people just died in a Walmart in Chesapeake, Virginia, and probably, you know, I hate to say it, will die in a mass shooting in the near future very soon. But what this is really hit me on another level was just the fact that there, you know, undeniably was one political party who, at least, you know, you don't have to say all the candidates, you know, but a big part of their political, a central tenet of their platform is demonizing queer people and, you know, making them into a threat, making them into, you know, an actionable threat time and time again, emboldening them through their policy and moving them, you know, slowly, slowly up through the ranks. These people who are literally, you know, have time and time again, they've actively calling people groomers, calling people pedophiles, all this kind of stuff. This, you know, it doesn't, as we saw, it doesn't work electorally very well. Most people, thank God, think this is crazy, but, you know, at least for now. But we saw what this can do. I think this guy doing this thing in a situation like this, you know, shows really just a testament to A, how sick our country is, and B, the fact that we saw, you know, the same people would push this political strategy. At least they didn't have the time to, you know, they didn't have the, you know, hypocritical nature to kind of come in and say, oh, you know, we stand with LGBTQ people after saying, you know, they just left him out completely. And it's in a situation where we had these people who, at least they were honest, they pushed violence. They call these people, you know, heathens. They think they're sick. They think they are outside of a humanity that they believe that, you know, quote unquote, normal people, straight people have, non-trans people have, all that kind of stuff. They literally believe that they are outside of that humanity and that they can essentially do whatever they want, and to those people, they can advocate for, you know, calling them pedophiles. They can call them all these sorts of names, incitations to violence. You know, you can have local Republican parties, these like essentially militia groups in Texas, posting every time there's going to be, you know, any kind of drag queen story hour or anything like that, and you have, you know, a small, you know, militia group outside, and that has been going on for, I don't even know, you know, well before the 2022 midterm campaign cycle. But this is a time where explicitly we have real Republican Republican figures, media figures, influential figures coming out and saying it's not that bad. You know, can they just, you know, and it's making effect. You know, there are news reporters who are reporting, getting, you know, unprecedented comments like, you know, enough with the club's Q shooting. Let's move on. You're talking about LGBTQ people way too much. You know, you're punishing, God is, you know, punishing a sin. Like, there are people who, you know, I doubt they would get this, you know, I don't even know if they got, you know, after the Buffalo shooting where black people targeted in a hate crime, you know, earlier this year, they didn't, like, people didn't get those messages, you know, not to say that there is a, you know, real revulsion against it, you know, but there was, like, this instinct of really, you know, turning up, you know, just, at least with mass shootings, not saying any kind of snide remarks, being unified and saying, hey, this is bad, there's a loss of life is bad. Really, the crazy thing, it felt like, you know, watching some of the coverage, watching people, you know, right-wing YouTubers, these influencers who, you know, to the adult, if you're listening to this, you know, say, oh, they're just YouTubers, and so, no, these people have reached, they've influenced millions of people, and they are making these people, you know, they make not caring about the fact that five people just got gunned down because they're gay, they make not caring about that okay. They make it seem normal. They make it seem like a normal thing to do. And you've had people come out on Tucker Carlson on Fox News, the most watched cable show in the country. You know, the chances are you know somebody. You almost certainly know somebody who has watched Tucker Carlson or watches it regularly, or at least know someone who knows someone. And it just shows you, like, this guy had somebody on saying, you know, the shootings will continue until the grooming stops, essentially, you know? Like, what do you expect when they're doing this grooming, this pedophilia? Like, these people believe this stuff. They're willing to act on this stuff. And it is so, and I'm not even, you know, part of that LGBTQ community. But, like, the fact that this is just so really just accepted in a way that I have never seen before, and, you know, all these mass shootings, all this stuff like that, just accepted as okay, and it's just like, because these people have just been portrayed, like, for political effect as subhuman, outside of, you know, the normal humanity that, you know, you and I, normal Americans, would share. That has led to the violence, and that is what is causing this huge uptick, and it's happening right now. It's building, and they are not even turning back on it, as five people have laid dead. You know, it's really shocking. It's really horrific. And I want to go to this piece here by Lauren Huff, I believe. I believe she's, you know, a member of the LGBTQ community. I should, you know, it's do a little Lauren Huff bio. She's an author. She's a New York Times bestseller and essayist, born in Berlin, Germany, and raised in seven countries, including Amarillo, Texas.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18+.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
She got into a bit of a Twitter feud, and she had to face allegation of transphobia one time with Sandra Newman, you know, back and forth. So earlier in March, she published Leaving Isn't the Hardest Thing. It was set to be nominated for the Lambda Literary Award in the category of Best Lesbian Memoir. The nomination seemed to capstone a remarkable debut in which, you know, really won critical acclaim, but then got called as, you know, kind of transphobic. And, you know, that obviously set up a whole debate that I'm not going to take any sides on. But, you know, you can read into that, you know, what you may hear on this. And we'll see what she's about in this article. Yeah, so I think she, but, you know, from what I've seen so far, she makes some really kind of interesting and important points, in the wake of the Colorado shooting. So, you know, they tell us not to flaunt it, she writes. They tell us not to shove it in their faces. They tell us not to talk about it. They tell us everything would be fine if we just kept it behind closed doors. They tell us these things during Thanksgiving dinner, at Christmas, after the kids have opened their gifts, while the game is on. And we wanted to try to talk, to explain, to give us a chance, them a chance to see us, to love us. We don't want to give up just yet. And I mean, like, that's really just, you know, it's so, you know, I think underappreciated, like, what it's like in so many parts of the country. We've seen this, like, wave of acceptance for gay rights, which is, like, kind of being met, obviously, by just this reactionary pushback now in the last few years. But it really is reality for so many people across the country, like, that, you know, homophobia is just really normalized or just believed by so many people. And just like the feeling of, you know, this, these Thanksgiving times where everything's so, you know, contentious for millions and millions of people all across the country. And the fact that, you know, queer culture is so sexualized, not just by, you know, queer people, it's by these, you know, straight people, these reactionaries, these conservatives who are all the time coming out and saying, you know, queer people, they're so sexual. Every, you know, every time they see a queer people, two boys together, you know, I think of them kissing. You know, it's just disgusting. Like, you know, like, that's always where they seem to go. And then this rhetoric, you know, just continues to build and build, just and get really just built up. Yeah, so when I heard about the news of the shooting at Club Q, an LGBTQ club in Colorado Springs, I couldn't help but think of the rhetoric spewed by those like James Dobson. We know what we're up against. We've heard it growing up in church and at home. We've heard these used words. We've heard the words they use in polite company about loving the sinner and hating the sin. We heard the words they've used when they've been listening to Christian radio or their actual minister or Rush Limbaugh or Fox News about abominations and predators in bathrooms and groomers on the internet, and words they've used when they've had one too many, the names they call those who could be our friends, who could be us. Those words we've heard and we were taught when we were in, we were forced to read a whole lot when those words came out of Colorado Springs, the headquarters of Focus on the Family, an evangelical organization whose founder, Mr. James Dobson, wrote books exhorting our evangelical parents on how to deal with strong-willed children, corporal punishment, a little pain goes a long way, and how to raise boys to be suitably masculine, who compared homosexuality to pedophilia, and who once offered a solution to fathers whose young women, whose young daughters had to share a restroom with trans women. If this had happened 100 years ago today, somebody might have been shot. Where is today's manhood? God help us. You know, it's just, it's, you know, this is the kind of rhetoric that's coming out of Colorado Springs. Focus on the Family. All these evangelical Mormon people who are just, you know, so big into this kind of religious hatred. And this media propaganda just spreads it and makes it normalized so, so effectively. It's really amazing. Some of us grew up and escaped to cities where we could feel, if not safe exactly, at least a little less alone. We could find jobs where we didn't have to hide who we were and tell lies about our roommate. We could find friends like us, a new family to replace the ones we've lost. Some of us stayed home or moved home when things didn't work out in the city. But that story's heartwarming only when the main character is a straight executive in a Hallmark movie. Some of us go home for the holidays where we're told to keep behind closed doors. We step outside to walk the dog so they don't see our tears. We call our friends back in the city. Our brother steps out to the porch to tell us when we ask our why our family can't just love us. It's all about the baby Jesus, because he's the only one who knows how much it hurts. And he's the only one who can still make us laugh about it. I think, you know, just kind of talking about, you know, the gay experience, the queer experience in general. Later on, when the kids are sleeping, Mom wants to watch It's a Wonderful Life. Some of us head to the bar. We don't need to know anyone there. We don't need to tag along. We don't need to know if it's a dance night or a drag show. We'll be all right. Just as soon as we walk through those doors, past the bouncer, checking IDs, up to the bar, where the impossibly cute bartender nods to let us know he's seen us. He did see us. Someone finally did. It's been a while. This is where we're safe. For many of us, it's the only place. They told us it would be okay. Behind those closed doors, they'd leave us alone. Often there's a drag show, a fundraiser for a homeless shelter for the queer kids whose parents listened to their evangelical leaders and threw their children out onto the streets. We've heard the panic about drag queens, and it'd be hard not to laugh if we didn't know the intent behind the manufactured panic. Drag queens talk about sex the way politicians talk about thoughts and prayers, and Christians talk about love. Everyone knows they're full of it. Drag queens are in on the joke. If you've ever been to a gay bar on a holiday or ever worked at a gay bar during a holiday, and I have, You get to watch the transformation of every person who walks through those doors. The unwinding of jaw muscles and shoulders and hips that start to roll about halfway across the room. The tone of voice that changes between the front door and the bar. You watch people become themselves. They throw back their first shot, the medicinal shot. Then find immediate friends down the bar or out on the patio. It's as beautiful as it is tragic. It's tragic because they were never going to leave us alone. No matter how quiet we kept it, no matter how much we hid it in front of them. The police came into our houses and dragged us out in handcuffs, printed the mugshots in the paper so our bosses and families and neighbors would know what they had told us to keep secret. The military harassed us and threatened us and threw us out, even though it said it wouldn't ask if we didn't tell. They don't want us to feel safe. They don't want us to be safe. Joshua Thurman, in a tearful interview after he survived the shooting last weekend, asked, "Where are we supposed to go?" The Stonewall riots began because they were lying then, too, when they told us to keep it behind closed doors. So we came out in the streets. We fought back. We fought back Saturday night, too. It was club patrons who stopped the gunman, who threw him to the ground and subdued him until the police arrived. And when they arrived, they placed handcuffs on one of those patrons, who said later the police locked him in the police car, briefly preventing him from tending to his family members who may have been wounded. But they weren't, luckily. The police, as an institution, were not built to protect queer people, not when politicians fearmonger about drag queens in bathrooms to rally an evangelical base. We'll protect ourselves, we'll fight for our own. We always have. We'll mourn, we'll raise money, we'll organize, and we'll keep fighting until all of us are safe everywhere. But tonight, I'm going to a gay bar. Maybe there'll be a drag show. Yeah, so that's Lauren Hoff. I think it's a really, really, you know, great, great essay there in the New York Times opinion pages recently, just showing in a very eloquent way the kind of experience of what's been like to be, you know, kind of be gay in this country, especially in some of the more evangelical, Christian, redder parts of the country. Which, you know, Colorado Springs certainly is, you know, James Dobson, Focus on the Family, that's all there. So it just shows you really how hard it is, you know, from one human rights story to another. You know, the World Cup is quite a segue here. But, yeah, the World Cup is quite an abomination in and of itself. You know, as we watch about the football, you know, it pays not to think too much about the wider environment surrounding football today. You know, it's really just excess greed, ferocious self-interest, and stark inequalities are its guiding principles. Repressive states, intoxicated on the rewards of fossil capital, now use the sport as a pawn in their geopolitical game, while fans market useless and ethically corrupt NFTs to their millions of fans. Sorry, while players market useless and ethically corrupt NFTs to their millions of fans. You know, just really just a football kind of becoming more and more money grabby, more and more kind of money hungry in a big way. In the face of this depressing scene, it's been encouraging to see several football associations and many international players take a stand on human rights in the lead up to the World Cup in Qatar. Surely no spectator can watch this World Cup without knowing the desperate plight of migrant workers, the repression of women in everyday life, and the crackdowns of freedom of the press and punishment of LGBTQ people. Whether spectators care or not is a different question, of course. But the signs are that the football teams would prefer the World Cup are not taking place in a country with such a terrible human rights record. The International Federation of Association Football, FIFA, of course, would rather we all focus on the game itself. As if football was somehow divorced from the, you know, 6,500 people who died to, you know, put the field together and, you know, build all the stadiums. It's even blocked the Danish football station from printing "Human Rights for All" on his training shirts, which is pretty crazy. The sports governing body has rightly been castigated for its attempt to stop associations, players, and fans from voicing their opinions on the human rights abuses in Qatar. But a challenging question lurks in the background: what does a term like "Human Rights for All" really mean? We reflexively employ the term "human rights" as if it can nullify any moral argument, but many of us can say we truly know exactly what we mean when we utter the words "human rights"? Which I think is a very interesting point. So, human rights have had a pretty contested and complicated history. In her seminal 1951 book, *The Origins of Totalitarianism*, Hannah Arendt, the philosopher, identified what she called the right to have rights, which in the context of Jewish persecution during World War II only came about when there suddenly emerged millions of people who had lost and could not regain these rights because of the new political situation. Arendt obviously had some pretty personal experience. As a Jew, she was forced to flee from Germany to Paris in 1933. After the Nazi invasion of France in 1940, she managed to find her way to the United States, where she was granted citizenship in 1951. Her point about the right to have rights was that in order to actually possess rights, a human being has to belong to some kind of political community, usually citizenship of a nation state. Simply being human enough is not itself. The chilling truth of Arendt's assertion is all too evident today. We talk about the migrant workers, the people who are just so poor in a nation that is so weak that they don't have, you know, really, by any, you know, standard definition, human rights, even though they are human. Routinely, it's the very people who are in desperate need of rights that lack the very right to have rights. Unquestionably, many of the rightless people who have toiled on the building sites of the stadiums in Qatar that will host this forthcoming, or, you know, in progress World Cup. Arendt's idea applies that the concept of human rights is not quite straightforward as we make out. Whereas FIFA tells us to leave the politics out of the World Cup, we often leave the politics out of human rights. But the ways in which we use language of human rights today is historically contingent. Human rights are pretty much always wrapped up in the ideological and political struggles of the second half of the 20th century. Because collective and individualistic worldviews, social welfare and market freedom and social democracy and neoliberalism and all that, those kind of ideas came to be at that time. The human rights that we invoke in debates about the World Cup are representative of, rather than antithetical to, the victory of individualism, market freedom, and neoliberal capitalism in these political struggles. So, you know, the rights are different comparatively to, you know, the system that we are in. You know, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, adopted by the UNGA on the back of the horrors of World War II, was a non-binding declaration that, you know, recognized that the inherent dignity and of equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family is the foundation of freedom, justice, and peace of the world. So they set out a general standard of human rights. For the first time in any substantive sense, they included economic and social rights, like the right to housing, food, and education. The inclusion of such rights in the UDHR not only indicated an emphasis on social welfare in the wake of the Great Depression, but also affected the strength of labor movements of the mid-20th century. And the work of the next two decades was, you know, turning these standards into binding obligations, obviously. So, yeah, those human rights are kind of defined by the UDHR. And then they were split in December 1966 into two covenants for all these kind of member nations that joined the UN. So the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights dealt with what we can broadly describe as individual rights. For example, freedom from torture and slavery, procedural fairness in the face of the law, freedom of movement, thought, and speech. Those were largely rights that could be secured through legal frameworks and could be generalized across national borders in some shape or form. The International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights was a little bit more tricky. It focused on collective rights such as the right to free education, health care, to join labor unions, and to have social security, paid parental leave, and an adequate standard of living. To enforce such rights required government resources to intervene in the free market and allocate resources in fair and equitable ways. Because of this requirement, the rights were much more beholden to the vagaries of nation-state politics than were civil and political rights. Notably, in the context of the Cold War, the United States did not ratify the International Covenant on Economic and Social Rights and has not done so for this day. Human rights in the era of neoliberalism changed it relatively significantly. Crucially, by the time each covenant became effective in 1976, the swinging 60s and its economic boom had given way to the stagflationary 70s and a global oil crisis. And a lot of the kind of political and economic order of the West looked to be in trouble. Strong welfare states, high taxation systems, and wealth redistribution policies had not prevented economic downturns and their associated social ills, such as unemployment and growing poverty. A new neoliberal counter-order was emerging in which many intellectuals, politicians, and policy advisors saw the possibility of using individual civil and political rights to protect against collective and economic and social rights. Samuel Moyne, historian, pinpoints the 1970s as the starting point of the human rights revolution, especially with the rapid rise of organizations like Amnesty International. But, as he points out, the most extraordinary fact about this human rights revolution from the perspective of ideals about how to distribute the good things in life is that, with some key exceptions, it unceremoniously purged the attention of economic and social rights. And really, almost using that first point, the cultural political rights, the right to speak your mind and post about whatever you want and be yourself, truly be that great little you that you can be. That was used to say, almost create this kind of illusion of complete, total, and utter freedom when it really comes to economic rights, economic tools that you have in your arsenal to better yourself. Those rights were being rapidly taken away. After the fall of the Soviet Union, many countries in the global north introduced some legal frameworks for the implementation of economic and social rights, but those paled in comparison to the frameworks on civil and political rights. Moreover, without strong welfare states, redistributive policies, and powerful labor movements, which had been dismantled under the ascendant neoliberalism of the 1980s, there were effectively few political or social structures to disseminate economic and social rights. Unsurprisingly, the economic and social rights were anathema to the neoliberal intellectuals of the mid-20th century, who viewed them as curtailing rather than facilitating human freedom. In a remarkable book, The Morals of the Market, Jessica White charts the intertwining histories of modern human rights and neoliberalism. As White puts it, the challenge for neoliberals was to overcome the egalitarianism of communal cultures and the assumption that basic welfare was a right, and to instill the morals of the market and a culture of individual rights as almost contrary to the idea of actually having economic rights that you can rely on and come back to again and again. The neoliberals saw the potential in civil and political rights as a way to guard against economic and social rights. As Milton Friedman, for example, argued, poverty rights are not in conflict with human rights. On contrary, they themselves are the most basic of human rights and an essential foundation for other rights. Poverty rights, the right to not to be in poverty, you may have thought it's one of, I misread it. He said property rights are not in conflict with human rights. On the contrary, they're themselves the most basic of human rights and essential foundation for other human rights. So, what if we take, shouldn't everyone have property? If that's all right, Milton Friedman, what do you think about that, bud? No. But by placing individual rights, like the right to private property, above all forms of collective rights, neoliberalism, really effectively used the language of human rights to insist that any policy of wealth redistribution on social welfare was effectively a violation of an individual's right to get rich and own some property. And that kind of, distinction, that, kind of definition of what's going on here, even as we look to, so many other countries, people like Gianni Infantino being like, Europe has some apologizing to do. Well, really, it's Milton Friedman and the neoliberal era that has some apologizing to do for fundamentally disconnecting the idea that, rights mean not just being able to, be able to speak freely, be able to protest, be able to, read whatever you want in a newspaper, be able to post whatever you want online. They also mean being able to join a union, being able to economically better yourself with your fellow, working class people, and actually being able to have that kind of freedom of assembly, economic, social rights, are really, really important.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
My name is Spencer Walsh. This is the Spencer Walsh Radio Network. And if you're listening to one of our podcasts, whether it's Newsflash, Hidden History, The Spencer Walsh Show, or something else, ladies and gentlemen, we have one simple request of you. Please be sure to rate us, subscribe to us if you like us, and leave us a comment, because just like all of you, sometimes we need that feedback in our lives, good or bad. We want to hear what you have to say. So please do those steps. Make SWR and content better. And thank you so much for listening. All right, gentlemen. Boy, oh boy, do I have a treat for you. Because today we're about to close up the show with a wonderful John Schwartz article about 10 things to be thankful for this Thanksgiving. A little bit of rare positivity for a change here on Newsflash. We start with Elon Musk, because boy, has this guy been incredible. Schwartz writing here, God bless this dork. Seriously, no one in history has so clearly demonstrated that the ultra wealthy who run the world have absolutely no idea what they are doing. Generally, they're smart enough to remain hidden behind the failings of their, money and guns, and, only ever giving interviews to, like, CNBC, and people who just absolutely love them and would fawn over them at any opportunity. But with Musk's purchase of Twitter, he was willing to come out and shout, "Here we go, into the future," and then trip down his shoelaces and fall down about 900 flights of stairs. Of course, there's a downside here. A prominent linguist named Edward Saper wrote this in a book published in 1921. everything that we have so far seen to be true of language points to the fact that it is the most significant and colossal work that the human spirit has evolved. Language is the most massive and inclusive art we know, a mountainous and anonymous work of unconscious generations. This is true about language, and on a smaller scale is, you know, true about Twitter. Twitter is a colossal work of art produced by hundreds of millions of people working together for free with no particular goal in mind. They just all had a burning need to share their miscellaneous thoughts with the universe. So if we'll be terrible, really, if Musk destroys Twitter, akin to Julius Caesar setting the Library of Alexandria on fire. You know, I don't know about that, but you know, there really was some great moments on Twitter. You know, seriously, I think it is like kind of crazy. I do think it's kind of crazy that, you know, we are, you know, seeing all these people do so many historical moments on Twitter, so many funny moments that people have just, you know, really kind of used Twitter would kind of get into and appreciate. But I think, you know, the world will survive without Twitter. It may even be, you know, a bit of a better place. But I think the best thing that Elon Musk has done is really, you know, prove to a lot of people, or at least given people who want to make this point more often, like such as myself, a good, perfect example, a case study in how billionaires are not the most effective runners of every single part of our society. You know, kind of showing them really the true nature of the situation. So a belief in the legitimacy of elections allows humans to live with one another without intermittent mass slaughter, you know, which is kind of a nice thing to have. Makes things a little bit more peaceful most of the time. At least for us here in this country. In 2020, Donald Trump decided that this was less important than his feelings getting hurt. It's never been exactly clear who he claims rigged the election, Diebold, Chavez, Dark Elves, but he's convinced about 70% of Republicans that Joe Biden was not, in fact, elected president. This is extremely bad news. The U.S. electoral system is a kludge kind of designed off really on 1787 by 39 delegates, just 39, to the Constitutional Convention, who are driven largely by an understandable desperation to leave Philadelphia. It is a janky, Rube Goldberg-esque machine filled with metaphorical dynamite that has generally failed to explode thanks to minimal good faith on all sides. But in 2022, many Republicans ran for positions that control the election machinery, promising that they won. They would, you know, kind of set this dynamite off. They would use those triggers. They would actually say, you know, for example, mail-in ballots, who needs them? We don't have to count them. It's no big deal. You know, we get to make these decisions. All these areas where we can run for Secretary of State or become a governor that gets to appoint the Secretary of State, that has a huge input on elections in key swing states, we're going to run for those positions. But, you know, the good thing is things have kind of, you know, America's come to its senses and decided they still want to have functioning elections. And, you know, it looks like they'll be going around for at least a little while longer. This is a good one here. Schwartz writing, at the funeral for my wonderful uncle 9 years ago, the priest explained that the first time he met every parishioner, he asked them what they like to do most. My uncle responded that his favorite life activity was thinking. Man, did I feel that. I someday hope that someone will say about me that someone will say that about me at my funeral. The point is that, you know, reality is busy and bizarre, so multifaceted that pondering it will keep you busy and happy for over 100 years. For instance, when a woman is born, her ovaries contain every egg she will ever have. This means that half the genetic material consists of what's once inside your maternal grandmother's body. Can you believe that? Also, you know, it is kind of sad for John that his uncle, rest in peace to John's uncle, gotta say that, John Schwartz, rest in peace to your uncle. Life in 2022 America suggests that Buddhists are really onto something with the concept of the hungry ghost. Hungry ghosts are the remnants of dead humans who are afflicted with the insatiable desires that for whatever reasons they can't satisfy. The Canadian writer John Ralston Saul has said that the interesting argument, made an interesting argument that Christianity, Islam, capitalism, communism, and Nazism all prosper through the cultivation of desire of the great world myths. Only Buddhism is centered on the reduction of desire in the individual. Is this true? I don't know. But if it is, Buddhism may be the only path forward for the survival of the Homo sapiens sapiens. On the other hand, widespread Buddhism would cause the entire world economy to collapse. So it's a bit of a mixed bag. But hey, maybe we need to start over again. We'll see what happens. One of my favorite things about Twitter is it is thriving community surrounding the 2007 movie Michael Clayton. If you've seen Michael Clayton, you already know this. If you haven't, please notify me so I can come over to your house to watch it with you, pausing it every 30 seconds to point out my favorite parts. So I've never seen this movie. But Michael Clayton was written by Tony Gilroy. Now he's taken his gargantuan talent and used it to make Andor, Disney Plus prequel to Rogue One. It's different to, you know, understand how he was allowed. It's kind of difficult to understand how he's allowed to do this. An honest log line for it would have had to read, what if all the classic Star Wars movies turned out to be childish fantasies masking unbearable tragedy? Plus, it cost hundreds of millions of dollars, you know? It was kind of weird, you know, what they've done to Star Wars, how they've made it modernized and kind of, you know, in the 2017 era versus the 2022 era. But, you know, I've heard some good things about Andor. It's been reviewed by some kind of people I like in a positive way. So I may watch it, you know, in the run-up to the holiday season. You know, Comptrollers, big shout out to Comptrollers. John Schwartz wants us to do big, also, by the way, shout out to Kenneth Mejia. We talked about him recently on the show. He has been amazing in LA. You know, and by the way, pay attention to some Comptrollers. If you want a race to get excited about, find a smart left wing guy or woman or non-binary person and get them out there, get them running, get them in control of your municipality's finances and make it, you know, help make the world a better place. Yeah, so here's what we are going to go for our next one. It's a little bit kind of controversial, but radish powder, cabbage, broccoli, cauliflower, all that stuff, you know, they're incredibly enough. You know, all these cruciferous vegetables are cultivated descendants of a single plant, the Brassica oleracea. And all of them contain two precursors that turn into a sulforaphane when you eat the plants raw. Sulforaphane, if you're a barbarian who doesn't know, appears to be one of the healthiest things you can imbibe. It may have cancer-suppressing, anti-inflammatory, anti-diabetic properties. The problem is that cooking destroys one of the sulforaphane precursors. Hence, if you delicious steamed broccoli, you're getting far less sulforaphane than if you eat raw broccoli, which is, you know, unfit for human consumption. But radish powder contains the precursor and is tasteless. All you need to do is sprinkle some on your, you know, on your broccoli with some garlic sauce, and it tastes just as good as eating the broccoli completely cooked. So, you know, radish powder, worth an investment. That's another interesting one. Taylor Swift, on the assumption that, you know, most people have eaten too much turkey and fallen asleep before getting to this part of the article, I'm going to admit here that I love Taylor Swift. I think she displays consistent craft in her songwriting, all right? You know, I see the judgy faces you're making, and I reject it. You drew stars around my scars, but now I'm bleeding. John Schwartz, you know, getting into his girl dad era, I think, with his love of Taylor Swift there. That's, you know, certainly a fair point, but, you know, there are much more creative songwriters. There are much more creative musicians out there, in my opinion, than Taylor Swift. Though she has done some good stuff in the past. That's my take. You know, some things I personally am thankful for is, honestly, college. I would have to say that, you know, just a little thing to kind of close out on my own is, you know, just a little bit of my own original idea that I'm thankful for. College is, you know, it's proven to be a pretty good place. And I think to any of you out there who may, you know, I don't know who listens to this, honestly, probably no one, but if you want to, you know, at least get, I'm about like a year and a half into college at this point, it's been going pretty well so far. And I just, you know, I'm thankful for it because it just really represents a, you know, remarkable opportunity to get the final experience of, or first experience really, of being away from home for the first time. I think that, you know, unless you go to a boarding school, which, you know, I personally wouldn't recommend, but unless you go to a boarding school, that is, you know, your first experience, your first time to really get out there, see how you handle yourself on your own. And what comes with a lot of challenges is really, really cool, because I think once you do it, it's so much better than, you know, being at home. And you feel like, you know, especially if you strict your parents, it's like, how did I ever even, you know, live with all those rules in the first place? Is sometimes, you know, what it feels like. So with that being said, you know, anyone who's out there applying to college at the moment, just know, I would say, it's all going to be absolutely fine. You're going to have a wonderful time wherever you go. Just remember, it's 4 years of your life where you're just in a literal bubble. Essentially, if you're, you know, you may end up with a lot of debt, but, you know, if you're blessed to not have to pay, you know, or pay a minimal amount of debt back, you know, just have a good time, enjoy it, and try and get an education while you're there as well. Because, you know, those 4 years, I feel like I'm a year and a half into it now, and I feel like, you know, this is, again, it's just something that you will not be, you know, experiencing in terms of experience in nature, good or bad. You will never experience anything quite like that in your life again. All right. Have a happy Thanksgiving, everyone. We'll be back Friday. Try to do an episode on Friday. Recover some from the turkey, the food coma, some Black Friday news. All right. Have a good Thanksgiving and holiday, everybody.